on it, and those who come and brief me every single morning do an extraordinary job. Then, with a look of concern, he glanced over at me and continued, I will say that the only flaw, generally, in what's called the PDB that I receive, is that when Jim provides it, some of you may have heard he leaves paper clips all over my office. He smiled, and the staff laughed as he continued, They're in the couch, they're on the floor, he's shuffling paper. Another pause, with more laughter. And so, because I knew I was coming over here, one of the things I did was return them all. With that line, he pulled out a jar filled with paper clips. The staff roared and applauded. He placed them on the podium and, addressing me, added, DNI's budget is always a little tight. We can start recycling these. That's going to be critical. That signed jar of paper clips became a treasure of mine, and it sat prominently on my desk for the rest of my tenure. Conceptually, changing the president's daily briefs was pretty simple, but merging two of ODNI's larger offices into a single force for leading the integration of the intelligence production cycle across 17 agencies and elements was more complex, to say the least. Fortunately, this was yet another area in which I was very fortunate to have exemplary work on which to build. In ODNI's first year, John Negroponte had established mission managers to focus on leading community approaches to difficult intelligence problems, initially North Korea and Iran. In 2010, the Iran mission manager was Norm Rule, who had turned his office into a coordination center, pulling together intelligence from around the community, piecing together the overall picture on everything from the nuclear reactor at Bushehr to political opposition to President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. His group was lining up the human and signals intelligence with overhead reconnaissance and defining gaps in collection, things our sources couldn't tell us. Social media became an important component of understanding Iran after the 2009 elections and the Green Movement protests, which were the largest demonstrations in 30 years since the Iranian Revolution. Norm's office wasn't running an operation or doing any collection on Iran. It was simply helping the agencies understand each other's work and coordinating so they could work together more effectively. Robert and I wanted to use that model to create 17 National Intelligence Managers, NIMs, some whose geographic areas of responsibility would be roughly analogous to the DoD combatant commands, like NIM Europe and NIM Africa, and others functional, like NIM Cyber and NIM Counterterrorism. Using what Norm's office was doing as a template, each NIM would create a strategy to make the most of the IC's collection and analysis capabilities and to identify where we should invest in new ones. We envisioned, given a year or more for all 17 NIM offices to establish themselves and the unifying intelligence strategies for their areas of responsibility, that they would be able to work together to put rigor behind the compilation of all the government's intelligence needs, the top tier of which was made up of the president's priorities. Increasingly, my own time was consumed with requests from the White House and Congress. On Monday, December 20th, I visited Capitol Hill to answer questions from senators who were about to vote on New START, the updated Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty between Russia and the United States, which was up for ratification. I sat in a small room from 1 p.m. to 3:30, and Pat Roberts was the only senator to stop by. When the designated time was up, I went straight to my SUV, and my protective detail drove me to the Eisenhower Executive Office Building to participate in an interview with Diane Sawyer of ABC News, along with John Brennan and Janet Napolitano. I'd been out of communications for almost 4 hours, and I didn't bother to check my BlackBerry during the short ride, a mistake I came to regret and tried never to repeat. On camera, Ms. Sawyer opened with, First of all, London. How serious is it? Any implication that it was coming here, Director Clapper? I didn't have a clue what her cryptic question referred to. She looked at me until I finally asked, London? John jumped in and explained that the UK had just made a series of arrests of suspected terrorists. I'd been following the surveillance in and around the London area, but hadn't known about the arrests. Sawyer smelled blood and came back to the subject a little later, commenting, "I was a little surprised you didn't know about London." I was a little irritated at that point and realized I was in trouble, but responded, "I'm sorry, I didn't." John, to his great credit, complained to Sawyer about her stunt after the interview. ABC waited 24 hours to air the interview and recut it to make me look completely out of touch. As was the reflexive response in Washington, some members of Congress called for me to be fired. After an NSC meeting, the president asked me to walk with him back to the Oval Office. He assured me that I had his confidence and enjoined me to learn a lesson from the experience, which I did. Always know what's in the headlines going into any interview. I got a very nice note from Secretary Clinton, which closed with the sentiment, "Finally, as a longtime observer and sometimes victim of the press gotcha game, don't let the First Amendment get you down. All the best, Hillary." In contrast to that bad day, February 18, 2011 was an extremely happy one for me, when Stephanie O'Sullivan was confirmed and became the principal deputy DNI, the PDDNI, which she pronounced as P. Diddy. Before Stephanie's arrival, I could assign big tasks to tremendously talented staff members and know they'd get done, but I still felt obligated to keep track of all the things I'd delegated. Stephanie stood beside me and helped shoulder the entire load. We approached problems from very different viewpoints, me as a political science major and former Air Force officer who'd spent a career in the defense intelligence ecosystem, she as an engineer who'd started her career designing and building marvelous technology projects, and then gone on to build teams of engineers and eventually, as CIA's Director of Science and Technology, lead an organization of some of the most brilliant scientists and technologists in the world. Although we approached intelligence challenges from widely contrasting perspectives, I can't recall a time when we ever disagreed about priorities or how to respond to them. More than once, I publicly adapted a line I'd first heard from Bob Gates, "Stephanie speaks for me, even when we haven't spoken." While Stephanie could speak for me, I was still less than comfortable speaking publicly for the community. A few weeks after she arrived, I managed to cause yet another distraction, this one during our annual series of worldwide threat assessment hearings. Every year between February and April, the DNI, accompanied by selected IC agency directors, appears in open hearings before the Intelligence and Armed Services Committees to discuss the threats to the United States and our allies around the world. These open hearings are fraught with potential pitfalls. One, of course, is the risk of compromising sources, methods, and tradecraft. Another is unintentionally offending another country. On at least three occasions, one of our ambassadors got summoned by a head of state to answer for something I said during testimony as DNI. A third pitfall is that the televised hearings could turn into a game of stump the chump, in which congressional members asked about parochial interests or obscure happenings in the far corners of the world, or about classified programs they knew I couldn't discuss in open sessions. This led me to lament years later that talking to Congress publicly about classified intelligence matters while trying to protect vital intelligence sources and methods is one of my favorite things to do, ranking right up there with undergoing oral surgery and folding fitted sheets. I was often struck by the contrast in how congressional members would often seem to play to the camera in open session, but when we'd adjourn to a closed, secure room to talk about the classified details, discussions were more businesslike and less frequently polemical. I can validate what Bob Gates wrote. "When the little red light went on atop a television camera, it had the effect of a full moon on a werewolf." In March, I got into trouble on camera. Again, when Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia asked me, in an awkwardly worded question, which nation-state posed the greatest threat to the United States. not a threat to U.S. interests, but to the United States. I tried to clarify the question and then responded that only Russia and China, with their nuclear arsenals, posed a mortal threat. I added the caveat that I was talking about capability and that intent was an entirely different matter. I also said that my biggest immediate concern was still non-nation-state terrorism. I wound up offending Russia and China, and once again the "fire the DNI" refrain arose. While all this was taking place, I was brought in on an extremely closely held intelligence project. Since September 11, 2001, the United States intelligence community had one mission that surpassed all others, at least emotionally: to find and capture or kill Osama bin Laden. In early 2011, we finally had a promising lead on his whereabouts. Truly stellar intelligence work by some dedicated analysts from CIA, NSA, and NGA had tracked him to a small compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan, near the Pakistan Military Academy. Collecting intelligence on the compound was a particularly difficult problem, because the site was 100 miles from the Afghanistan border. Pakistan was a key ally in the Afghan war, and the bulk of our supply lines traversed it, yet we didn't trust the Pakistani Inter-Services Intelligence Agency at all. In fact, they had a history of tipping off targets for us, proxies for them, ahead of raids. At the same time, the Pakistanis were very suspicious about U.S. intelligence, which made it difficult to conduct human intelligence work. It was hard not to wonder if some of the Pakistanis knew bin Laden was in Abbottabad and were protecting him. Bin Laden himself went to extreme lengths to minimize his exposure to prying eyes and cameras that might see into the compound's garden. While we had glimpses of a tall man in white strolling there, intelligence analysts were unable to identify any communications that would verify his presence, given his meticulous communication security discipline. In the end, while CIA experts led the effort to confirm that the man was in fact bin Laden, it was really superb teamwork and intelligence integration that built the case. The CIA has rightly received a great deal of credit for their incredible work, but the ensuing raid would not have happened without the efforts of NSA and NGA as well. As spring approached, the briefings to National Security Advisor Tom Donilon became more intense, urgent, and frequent. Two questions consumed those meetings. How certain were we that bin Laden was there? And what would be the best way to capture or kill him? Each senior member of the national security team, including me, had different perspectives and levels of confidence in the intelligence we had. By March and April, we were meeting regularly with the President and Vice President and discussing four options: obliterate the compound with an airstrike in a suburban setting in a nation we weren't at war with, use a remotely piloted drone to perform a more surgical strike, conduct a special operations raid, or continue to gather more intelligence. Other accounts I've read discount option four, but without confirmation that bin Laden was in the compound, doing nothing and continuing to watch was a perfectly valid response. It risked losing bin Laden again, but didn't risk jeopardizing Pakistani support. The analysts who had been tracking him, some for years, felt sure it was bin Laden, and though the CIA tried several innovative approaches to obtain confirmation, by April, we hit the point at which we feared doing more would tip either bin Laden or the Pakistanis that we were wise to his whereabouts. The longer we waited, the more concerned we became about an inevitable leak. Sometimes speaking difficult truths means admitting that we don't know for certain and leaving the decision-maker with a tough call to make. The final interagency briefing occurred on Thursday, April 28th. The analysts presented their best case and concluded that, short of bin Laden's slipping up by taking a stroll outside the compound, the intelligence we had was as good as it was going to get. The President went around the table and asked each of us for our opinion on what course of action to take. Most felt the intelligence was sufficient enough to act upon, and most favored the raid. Bob Gates, who was personally responsible for any troops who would be put at risk, preferred the drone strike option. Vice President Biden had low confidence that the intelligence warranted the risk, and he preferred maintaining vigilance and taking no direct action. When it came around to me, I told the president that because this was a policy decision, I was speaking as Jim Clapper and not as the DNI. I said that I preferred the idea of the raid because special operators on the ground were rational actors who could change the plan if they discovered that bin Laden wasn't there or that the compound was something other than what we thought it was. I told him I felt confident in the intelligence because the experts most intimately involved had a high degree of confidence. As was the president's practice, he did not make a decision at this meeting, preferring to contemplate it further outside the Situation Room. Again, I thought of the quote from General George Patton, "The time to take counsel of your fears is before you make an important battle decision." That's the time to listen to every fear you can imagine. When you have collected all the facts and fears and made your decision, turn off all your fears and go ahead. The following day, I was told the president had made the courageous and what proved to be correct decision for elite special operations forces to conduct a raid on April 30th. As has been well documented, he and several others of the group planned to be at the White House correspondents' dinner that Saturday night, which would have meant our all quietly slipping out to monitor the progress of the raid. But because the weather in Pakistan turned bad, the raid was postponed until Sunday. The president was in rare form at the correspondents' dinner, which took place just a few days after the state of Hawaii had released his long-form birth certificate, putting an end to the conspiracy theory that he was born in Kenya. Halfway through his 18-minute comic monologue that night, the president turned to Donald Trump, sitting three tables away from me, who had been leading the birther conspiracy charges. The president said, "Now I know that he's taken some flack lately, but no one is happier, no one is prouder to put this birth certificate matter to rest than the Donald. And that's because he can finally get back to focusing on the issues that matter, like, did we fake the moon landing? What really happened in Roswell? And where are Biggie and Tupac?" President Obama spent 2.5 minutes poking fun at Trump, drawing laughter and applause throughout. He closed the bit with, "Say what you will about Mr. Trump, he certainly would bring some change to the White House." And the screens around the room showed a photoshopped image of the White House turned into a tacky hotel with Trump emblazoned across the front in neon lights. Trump smiled and waved, but after the cameras turned away, I could tell he was seething. The president remained calm, cool, and collected throughout the evening, although he must have realized that anything he said at the dinner would likely be overshadowed within 24 hours. On Sunday morning, we gathered again in the Situation Room. Admiral Bill McRaven was in Afghanistan controlling the mission, although given its nature, the operation was conducted as a covert action under CIA authorities, and so Leon Panetta was nominally in charge at CIA headquarters. Much to Leon's credit, he made no effort to foster the optic that he was in command or to interfere with Bill's leadership. Remembering stories of President Nixon ordering airstrikes in Vietnam, Tom Donilon was concerned that we not convey the image that the White House was micromanaging the raid, and so we started out in the Situation Room all staring at a blank screen. As Bob Gates notes in his memoir, Duty, Air Force Brigadier General Marshall Webb was in a small adjoining breakout room monitoring a video feed of the compound, and we eventually all drifted in and crowded around him. President Obama refused to take the seat at the head of the table. After losing my seat to Dennis McDonough when I took a bathroom break, I wound up standing behind Hillary Clinton to watch. That's where we were when White House photographer Pete Souza snapped the famous photograph, not in the Situation Room, but in a breakout room just across the hall. Given the historical importance of that photo, I would make two observations. One, Robert Cardillo, who was sitting to Vice President Biden's right, was literally cropped out of history. Two, I want to take a rare opportunity to correct Bob Gates. In his memoir, he notes that the photo was later famously photoshopped to portray everyone as superheroes. Bob writes, Obama was Superman, Biden Spider-Man, Hillary Wonder Woman, and I, for some reason, was the Green Lantern. No, Bob, Biden was the Flash, and you were the Martian Manhunter. My comic book collection may have been lost to antiquity, but I remember Dennis McDonough was photoshopped as Green Lantern, and that would have been me if he hadn't taken my seat. To answer the other question often raised about the photo, yes, it was that tense in the room. As Bob notes, we watched as the first helicopter crashed. Bill McRaven came over our link to reassure us that the Raiders would go to a backup plan, which they did. But we still worried about the mission and egressing the compound. When the team went into the house, there was nothing but silence for what seemed like an eternity. Finally, we heard, Geronimo, EKIA. Geronimo was the code word for Osama bin Laden, and EKIA meant enemy killed in action. I think everyone in that room appreciated what a courageous decision the president had made in ordering the raid. We'd all played out the scenarios for what might happen if the attack went wrong, either by the Pakistanis being alerted to the plan, by American forces encountering resistance on the ground, or by their inability to get access to the compound, or if the intelligence had been wrong. The public history of U.S. intelligence traditionally reads as a narrative of failures and shortcomings, certainly dating back to the U.S. misadventure in Southeast Asia. These include our virtual non-participation in Grenada, our failure to foresee precisely the collapse of the Soviet Union, not serving General Schwarzkopf well with imagery during the Gulf War, and are having very little foundational intelligence for Somalia and later Afghanistan. Errors were made that led to massive tragedies, such as allegedly not connecting the dots to prevent 9/11, and then connecting dots that weren't really there, which helped lead us into Iraq. And there were mistakes that could have ended in tragedy and didn't, like Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab boarding a flight on Christmas Day 2009 with explosives in his underwear. When we did get it right, though, when we stop someone from boarding a plane bound for the United States, or when we prevent dangerous materials from being shipped across borders, we almost never discuss it publicly, mostly because we don't want to lose our ability to repeat our success. And here's the interesting point about intelligence officers and special operators working together on that particular raid. On almost any given night, similar raids built on similar partnerships were almost certainly occurring somewhere in Afghanistan. We were having success after success, devastating Al-Qaeda and the Taliban leadership, and not revealing our achievements or the operations that led to them, unless the operation went wrong, which meant a tragedy that required a public accounting. In planning the Abbottabad raid together, our communities had certainly discussed our hope that within Osama bin Laden's house, we'd find the intelligence that would enable operations to put the final nail in the coffin of Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. An intelligence failure in Abbottabad would have had major diplomatic repercussions and might have endangered Pakistani support for the fight against the terrorists, a potential outcome we were all aware of and dreaded. I suspect no one more than the president. But on May 1, 2011, the intelligence had been right and the raid a success. After more than a decade of searching, we'd found the mastermind of the 9/11 terrorist attacks and had removed him from the battlefield. But there was no immediate celebration, no shouting, no fist pumping, no high-fiving. We only breathed a collective sigh and glanced around at one another before smiling, not in jubilation, but in relief. Of course, the mission wasn't over, and we didn't leave the breakout room until the team had gathered up all the hard drives, cell phones, thumb drives, books, and anything else they thought might have intelligence value, and left the compound, and no one left the Situation Room until the team was safely in Afghan airspace. Admiral Mike Mullen drew the short straw to place a phone call to Pakistani Army Chief of Staff General Kayani to inform him of the raid, before President Obama announced bin Laden's death to the American public. Based on the surprised reaction he got, Mike was confident that the Pakistanis hadn't realized that bin Laden was in Abbottabad. I visited Pakistan a month and a half later, after accompanying Hillary on a trip to India, and the hostility with which I was treated confirmed in my mind that they had indeed been unaware of bin Laden's whereabouts and considered our raid an egregious affront to their national sovereignty. I was still at the White House at 11:35 p.m. when President Obama strode to the microphone and announced, "Tonight I can report to the American people and to the world, the United States has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden, the leader of Al-Qaeda and a terrorist who is responsible for the murder of thousands of innocent men, women, and children." By the time he spoke, people had already heard rumors that the CIA and SEAL Team 6 were involved in the raid. That, of course, was an oversimplification of both the intelligence and special operations efforts. The incredible contributions from NSA and NGA never really made it into public awareness. But that night, our intelligence community got a public win.
I will never forget hearing the crowd that had gathered across the street in Lafayette Park chanting,
"USA! USA!" Leon later claimed they were chanting, "CIA! CIA!" For days and weeks after the raid, the CIA public phone lines rang with callers who just wanted to offer their gratitude. It gave long-awaited closure to the nation, to the intelligence community, especially the CIA, and, for that matter, to me personally. I had been DNI for just 9 months, and I wondered if I'd just realized what would be the high point of my tenure.
Chapter 6. Benghazi. 4.5 months before the raid at Abbottabad, a fruit vendor in the small town of Sidi Bouzid, located near the center of Tunisia, reached the end of his fuse. Something close to one-third of the locals were unemployed, and Mohamed Bouazizi had tried for years to get a job, any job. The only way he could support his family was by selling fruit from a cart while dealing with regular harassment from police and government officials who couldn't cite any actual laws he was violating. On December 17th, a local bureaucrat, accompanied by a few other officials, approached him and announced she was confiscating his fruit, his scale, and his cart. He resisted, and in front of the crowd that had grown to watch the drama, she slapped him. Or perhaps she asked for a bribe before the confrontation got physical. Witness accounts vary on the details. Afterward, Bouazizi, perhaps injured, walked to the local governor's office and demanded compensation for his loss, or demanded return of his scale, or just demanded to be heard. When the governor refused to see him, Bouazizi procured a can of gasoline, or maybe paint thinner, walked back to the middle of the street in front of the governor's office, poured the liquid over himself, and set himself on fire. Witnesses agree that less than an hour passed from the time of the initial confrontation to his self-immolation. Bouazizi lived another 18 days before slipping away on January 4th. He never regained consciousness and never learned what his action had triggered. The intelligence community had been warning about potential instability in northern Africa and southwest Asia for many years. Factors like food and water shortages and poor living conditions, increasingly driven by climate change, oppression of political freedoms, corruption by autocratic governments and rulers who had been in place for decades, massive unemployment leading to a breakdown in social structure, and a large population bubble of young, single, disaffected men in those parts of the world made them extremely unstable and a fertile recruiting ground for Al-Qaeda. By 2010, the group had three major franchises in Africa and the Middle East: Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, operating in northern Africa, primarily Algeria, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, operating in Yemen and Saudi Arabia, and Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which had rebranded itself as the Islamic State in Iraq, in 2006, after a falling out with Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, partly over the Iraqi group's use of brutal terrorist tactics against fellow Muslims. Of course, the other factor leading to the formation of Al-Qaeda in Iraq was the U.S. invasion in 2003 and the resulting anti-U.S. insurgency, in which the organization took a lead role. But in December 2010, the same destabilizing factors that led to terrorists gaining a hold in its neighbors had dramatically different results in Tunisia. Tunisia is much smaller than its neighbors, Algeria and Morocco to its west and Libya and Egypt to its east, but it has a long coastline on the Mediterranean Sea, including Africa's northernmost point, less than 100 miles from Sicily. Algeria is about the size of the entire U.S. South, from Texas and Oklahoma all the way to Delaware. Libya is about the same size if you take out 2/3 of Texas. Tunisia is a little smaller than Florida, but because of its long, more densely populated coastline, its population tops 11 million people, almost twice that of Libya. Still, Western society hasn't thought of Tunisia as a major power in the civilized world since Carthage was destroyed by Rome in 146 BC. 2 millennia later, a fruit vendor in a small central Tunisian city sparked a fire that would engulf North Africa and the Arabian Peninsula. Just a few hours after Mohamed Bouazizi's dramatic action, protests began in Sidi Bouzid. Demonstrators shared pictures and video on Facebook and Twitter, and the unrest soon spread to other cities. Tunisian President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali had been in power since 1987, 23 years of quickly quelling disturbances with violence. However, even as police cracked down, injuring and killing demonstrators, the strife continued, with riots erupting nationwide. On January 14, 2011, Ben Ali fled Tunisia for Saudi Arabia, resigning the presidency en route. Protests continued until March 9, when Ben Ali's political party was dissolved and all its members removed from power. Tunisia would struggle for another 3.5 years to establish an accepted, functioning, elected government, but the people eventually took control of their destiny. This Arab Spring, which did not actually start on the Arabian Peninsula, spread across North Africa and into the Middle East. By February 10th, when I testified in my first televised congressional hearing as DNI, presenting the intelligence community's annual worldwide threat assessment, protests were underway in Egypt, Algeria, Sudan, Djibouti, Oman, Yemen, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia, with the situation in Egypt the most tense and violent. In the previous few weeks, my schedule had been shuffled repeatedly to attend Principals Committee and National Security Council meetings. At each, I was required to give an intelligence update, which mostly consisted of noting the new protests and military crackdowns, along with briefing any intercepted communications that gave us insight into how specific leaders planned to respond to what was happening in their respective countries. I always cautioned the president and secretaries that intelligence work was about acquiring and assessing foreign secrets, not predicting events or reading minds. In the case of Egypt, for example, unless and until Hosni Mubarak decided for himself and then informed someone of his intentions, we didn't have much insight on when he might step down as president of Egypt or whether he would order troops to fire on the protesters in Tahrir Square. My role was to offer the intelligence community's assessment, for instance, that President Mubarak was unlikely to hold power for long, and that when he stepped aside, the Egyptian military would likely take control of the government, at least in the short term. If Egypt held elections within the next few months, we assessed that the Muslim Brotherhood was the only political party well enough organized to win a majority of seats in the country's parliament. While in 2011 the Brotherhood in Egypt was mostly focused on secular concerns of Egyptians, as opposed to Muslim Brotherhood groups in other nations that were encouraging terrorist acts. The Egyptian Brotherhood did have its roots in jihadism, and its hardline and moderate factions were fighting for control. The Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood was unlikely to be friendly to American interests, but we could probably work with them if they came to power. There were other scenarios, both better and worse. If there was a significant delay before Egyptian elections, other political parties could get organized and have a better chance of holding or sharing power, although there was a chance that the Egyptian military could maintain control indefinitely, a situation no one wanted. With those assessments on the table, I left the discussion to Secretaries Gates and Clinton and Vice President Biden, who typically led the debate on what to do. After a meeting on February 1st, President Obama had reached out to President Mubarak, asking him to step down peacefully, now. In getting ready for the February 10th threat assessment hearing with the House Intelligence Committee, I hadn't participated in any specific preparatory sessions on what was happening with the Arab Spring, partly because I was reading a lot about it for White House meetings, and partly because the situation was changing so quickly that studying a week in advance would mean absorbing facts that would have changed by the hearing. But the Arab Spring wasn't the only worldwide threat concern. And so, between January 25th and February 8th, I specifically brought experts in to help me study the specifics regarding North Korea, China, Russia, Iraq, Iran, Yemen, Africa as a whole, Afghanistan and Pakistan, counterterrorism, proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, cyberspace, Latin America, Guantanamo Bay, WikiLeaks and counterintelligence, intelligence information sharing, and transnational threats. I also went through three murder boards at which my senior staff played the roles of senators and representatives and tried to stump the chump. I quickly learned that I wasn't easily tripped up by trivia or clever questions. Instead, I had more trouble with questions that seemed to be about intelligence matters, but were really about partisan or personal politics to which I wasn't attuned. In my opening statement on February 10th, I cited international terrorism and the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction as the threats of most concern to the IC. Of the Arab Spring, I said that we'd consistently reported on tensions and instability in the Middle East and Africa, but when it came to predicting the specific triggers that could lead to regime collapse, we are not clairvoyant. During the hearing, Representative Sue Myrick asked me about the threat that the Muslim Brotherhood posed to the United States. I tried to explain that there really was no transnational Muslim Brotherhood organization, and at the moment, the political party by that name in Egypt was more concerned about the day-to-day concerns of Egyptians than threatening America. But unfortunately, that came out as, the term Muslim Brotherhood is an umbrella term for a variety of movements. In the case of Egypt, a very heterogeneous group, largely secular, which has eschewed violence and has decried Al-Qaeda as a perversion of Islam. I believe rather than secular, the word I'd meant to use was pragmatic. Regardless, I was skewered in the press as being out of touch with reality. How could the Brotherhood be considered secular when the word Muslim was right there in their name? For 2 hours, we'd discussed serious threats to the nation and to U.S. interests around the world, but the media coverage focused on my gaffe, which I found both irritating and distracting. On the following day, Vice President Omar Suleiman announced Mubarak's resignation as President of Egypt, and the Supreme Council of the Egyptian Armed Forces took control of the government. On Saturday, February 13th, Arab Spring-related protests began in Iraq, where the United States was negotiating with the Iraqi government over the expiring Status of Forces agreement that governed the 47,000 troops still in the country. On February 14th, protests started in Bahrain, home to the U.S. Navy's 5th Fleet and another 7,000 U.S. troops. On February 15th, protests in Benghazi, Libya were put down by military force. On February 16th, I testified at the Senate Intelligence Committee's televised threat hearing, for once not saying anything that prompted Congress to call for my resignation. In late February and March 2011, with the military Supreme Council in stable control of Egypt, our focus on the Arab Spring uprisings shifted to Libya. As a quick geospatial and historic orientation, which becomes very important shortly, looking eastward from the northernmost point of Tunisia, the African coastline falls sharply to the south to the border with Libya, where it curves eastward. The capital city of Tripoli is about halfway along the 200 miles or so of Libyan shoreline running to the east, before it dips southward again at the western shore of the Gulf of Sirte. On the eastern shore is the port of Benghazi, Libya's second-largest city. Benghazi and Tripoli are about 400 miles apart. About 85% of Libya's population lives near the coastline, which has been the case stretching back for millennia. Libya didn't really exist as a nation until 1951. Before that, the three regions of Libya, Cyrenaica and the city of Benghazi to the east, Tripolitania and Tripoli to the northwest, and Fezzan to the southwest, had for centuries mostly been sequentially governed as separate colonies of various empires. Then in 1951, 8 years after seizing the colonies from Italy in 1943, the Allies put King Idris I on the Libyan throne. In 1969, Colonel Muammar Gaddafi led a military coup to overthrow the only Libyan king to ever exist, and Gaddafi officially took control as the brother leader in 1977, ruling Libya as an Islamist socialist state. Gaddafi governed with particular animosity toward the United States, the United Kingdom, and Israel. He sponsored terrorist organizations in Syria and Palestine, and was responsible for both the 1986 West Berlin nightclub bombing that targeted U.S. service members, and for the 1988 Lockerbie bombing, the in-flight destruction of Pan Am Flight 103. Since the 1970s, he had also sought to make Libya a nuclear power by attempting to buy weapons or production equipment, sequentially from China, the Soviets, Pakistan, and India. He hadn't succeeded in doing so, but Libya did launch a large chemical weapons program. After 9/11, President Bush purportedly warned Gaddafi to either abandon his chemical weapons and his nuclear program, or the United States would destroy them. After the American invasion of Iraq in 2003, whether from fear of a similar incursion or as an effort to mend his diplomatic relationship with the West, Gaddafi did give up his nuclear program and asked for international assistance in ridding Libya of chemical weapons. By 2011, much of his stockpile had been removed, but large amounts of mustard gas and the chemicals to make sarin were still under Libyan military control, along with bombshells configured to deliver chemical weapons. We didn't know if Gaddafi would use those remaining weapons to quell protests in his country. On February 17, 2011, groups opposed to Gaddafi's government in Tripoli declared a day of rage, quickly seizing Benghazi. Libyan army and police forces either stood aside or joined the cause. Gaddafi's country had effectively split. He maintained control of Tripoli, its population of more than 1 million, and territory to the west, while the opposition, a mix of civilians, police, armed forces, and Islamist militias who'd found a common cause, held Benghazi, its population of 700,000, and the territory to the east. As the opposition pushed west as far as the port of Misrata, it looked to many observers like another North African strongman would fall, one the United States government truly despised. But Gaddafi had no intention of going quietly. His loyal military units fired into public demonstrations in the capital city, and other military units pushed eastward to retake territory. Along with most other nations, the United States closed its embassy in Tripoli and evacuated as many of its citizens as it could. The international team working on destroying the country's chemical weapons also left the embattled country. In Washington, we continued to hold contentious National Security Council meetings with the president. The intelligence I presented pointed to Gaddafi's having all the military advantages, including control of the Libyan air defense structure, which was the second largest, after Egypt's, in the Middle East. The Libyan government had 31 major surface-to-air missile, SAM, sites, a radar complex focused on protecting the coastline, and a large number of portable SAM systems. Its Air Force had a few hundred aircraft, and although not very many were operational, they'd used both fighters and helicopters to attack opposition forces and protesters. Further, the 32nd Libyan Army Brigade and the 9th Regiment were robustly equipped with Russian equipment, air defense, artillery, tanks, and mechanized equipment. They were disciplined and loyal to Gaddafi, and I gave the U.S. intelligence assessment that, without outside intervention, they would regain ground and eventually prevail. At those meetings, Hillary Clinton pushed for military intervention in pursuit of regime change, while Bob Gates pushed back, pointing out that we already had two Middle East wars to prosecute, and because of Gaddafi's formidable air defenses, setting up a no-fly zone would require extensive strikes, drawing resources from the other wars. I could see the reasoning on both sides of that argument, and I could tell that President Obama did too. I didn't envy his having to decide on a course of action. On March 3rd, the president addressed Libya in a public statement. "The United States and the entire world continues to be outraged by the appalling violence against the Libyan people. The United States is helping to lead an international effort to deter further violence, put in place unprecedented sanctions to hold the Gaddafi government accountable, and support the aspirations of the Libyan people." He committed U.S. military planes to help refugees return home, particularly Egyptian citizens who had fled west into Tunisia, and he pledged humanitarian assistance. Later in his remarks, he said, "The violence must stop. Muammar Gaddafi has lost legitimacy to lead, and he must leave. Those who perpetrate violence against the Libyan people will be held accountable. And the aspirations of the Libyan people for freedom, democracy, and dignity must be met." He stopped just short of committing the U.S. military to make that happen. The following week, with the United States and NATO still on the sidelines, Gaddafi's forces pushed east toward Benghazi as Libya became entrenched in a full-blown civil war. On March 10th, I again gave televised testimony in presenting the IC's worldwide threat assessment to the Senate Armed Services Committee. I knew that the intelligence update on Libya was going to be controversial. While the president had called for Gaddafi to step down and the press and public supported the forces that opposed him, we still weren't doing anything. The day before the hearing, French President Nicolas Sarkozy had officially recognized the National Transitional Council in Benghazi as the true government of Libya. We had not. During the hearing, when I was asked whether the United States should officially acknowledge the government in Benghazi, I demurred, saying that the question was in the policy lane, not intelligence. But congressional questions about the status of the civil war in Libya and how the opposition to Gaddafi was faring did require truth-to-power answers. I couldn't deflect them or paint the picture as rosy, neither for Congress nor for the American people. So in response to Chairman Carl Levin's and Vice Chairman John McCain's opening questions, I replied, "Gaddafi is in this for the long haul. I don't think he has any intention, despite some of the press speculation to the contrary, of leaving. From all the evidence we have, which I'd be prepared to discuss in closed session, he appears to be hunkering down for the duration." Later in the hearing, in response to a question from Senator Joe Lieberman, I went further in assessing what might happen without outside intervention. "It's a stalemate back and forth, but I think over the longer term that the regime will prevail." I was again lambasted in the press for speaking intelligence truth that went against the more appealing narrative that policymakers in Congress and executive departments were pushing. That afternoon, National Security Advisor Tom Donilon undercut my assessment calling it a static and one-dimensional assessment, and Senator Lindsey Graham called for me to be fired. That night, back at the office, I took a call from John McCain, who said that I had his support to keep telling it like it is. He offered that while he and his close friend Lindsey often agreed on issues, he thought Senator Graham had shot from the lip on this one. 9 days after the hearing, with a UN resolution in hand, the U.S. military began taking out Libyan air defenses, first with cruise missiles and then with escorted bombing runs. With help from the British, French, and Canadian air forces, and drawing on targets identified by multinational intelligence efforts, the U.S. military established a safe no-fly zone in 4 days and turned the mission over to NATO control. Gaddafi pleaded for the United States and then NATO to stop the attacks, citing his cooperation with weapons inspectors, his voluntary disarmament of his nuclear program, and his restraint from using chemical weapons in his current civil struggle. It was far too late, and no one in the West paid attention. However, I believe North Korea and Iran took careful note of what happens when you give up your nuclear program, and Bashar al-Assad in Syria saw what happens to dictators who show restraint. Under the NATO airspace umbrella, and with some limited close air support, the opposition forces in Libya took the initiative. In June, realizing he could no longer prevail, Gaddafi offered a ceasefire to hold elections, promising to step aside if he didn't win. The war continued, and on August 22nd, the opposition penetrated Tripoli. By then, Gaddafi had escaped the city and was nowhere to be found. Within days, the opposition announced they had control of the capital. However, no one was in charge, and pro-Gaddafi troops still roamed the streets, firing on fighters and demonstrators alike. On October 20th, the last of Gaddafi's forces was pinned down in the port city of Sirte as the opposition closed in, unaware that Gaddafi was with them. Attempting to flee, Gaddafi raced out of the city in a convoy of 75 cars, but was spotted and fired on by NATO aircraft. He took shelter in a stormwater culvert, where he was found by opposition fighters. The jubilant group dragged him off, and within hours, the National Transitional Committee announced his death, although they couldn't agree on how he died. One member said he was captured alive and executed. Another claimed he was caught in crossfire and found dead. Soon, several cell phone videos posted on the Internet told a different story. In one, his captors slowly tortured him with a bayonet as he screamed and pleaded for his life. For U.S. intelligence, it was a chilling reminder that we had no idea who or what was going to replace Gaddafi in Libya. At the moment, no one was in control. Despite sporadic fighting as mercenaries and pro-Gaddafi groups continued to clash with the new government's forces in the shadows of the capital, the United States had reopened its embassy in Tripoli on September 22nd. Violence was prevalent throughout the country as massive numbers of people tried to return home. Tunisia and Egypt reported that they had received some 500,000 Libyan refugees in 2011, and many more had gone south or been evacuated via flights and ferries into Europe. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees estimated another 200,000 people were displaced internally, having abandoned their homes without leaving Libya. In a nation of just 6 million people, those were huge numbers. The National Transitional Council nominally remained the national governing body, but its focus was on drafting a national constitution and preparing for elections, not governing. The Libyan people hadn't governed themselves in 2,800 years, and in the 6 decades since the Allies had made Libya its own kingdom in 1951, they'd had one king and then 42 years of autocratic rule. Self-governance was a novel idea, and while representative democracy seemed, through an American lens, to be the obvious best end state, the Libyan people weren't united behind the council's efforts. In January 2012, its headquarters in Benghazi was attacked by protesters who wanted the country to become an Islamic caliphate,
governed by Sharia law. No one was hurt, but the incident demonstrated that the council was not in control. On Friday, April 27th, I met with Chris Stevens, who was slated to replace Gene Kretz as the U.S. ambassador to Libya. Chris had an affinity for the Libyan revolution. When, during the worst of the war, from March until November of 2011, the United States had closed its embassy in Tripoli and evacuated its diplomats, including Ambassador Kretz, Chris had been the U.S. Special Representative to the National Transitional Council in Benghazi. During our brief meeting, he struck me as an American patriot and a true believer in democracy. He was elated that he would be present for Libya's first free elections. Before he left my office, we discussed the deteriorating security situation in Libya and the very real dangers posed by local militias, some of which held extreme Islamist ideologies. Security was reliable for the embassy in Tripoli, but he could not be as certain about conditions elsewhere in the city or around the country. He had no illusions about the danger he was going back to, but he indicated that he felt a U.S. presence could make a difference to the birth of democracy in this new independent nation, and so it was worth calculated risks. We talked about working with the CIA and about where to draw the line between intelligence and diplomacy. My last words as he was heading out the door still haunt me. As he glanced back, I told him, "Stay safe." Chris arrived in Tripoli on May 22, 2012. Libyan national elections were held on July 7th, and the National Transitional Council handed power to the General National Congress on August 8th in a ceremony on Martyrs Square. Intelligence reports noted that the government still had little control of the security situation, and that al-Qaeda was attempting to establish a foothold in the country, which they'd been unable to do while Gaddafi had ruled. Local militias with heavy military equipment, remnants from the war, controlled the streets, particularly in places like Benghazi, where a dozen or more militias were rivals for power. Some supported the government, others didn't. In June, a group called Ansar al-Sharia had paraded through Benghazi with artillery, demanding the National Transitional Council abandon the planned elections and instead impose Sharia law. We in the IC knew that Chris was facing an uncertain and dangerous situation. Meanwhile, U.S. policy focus had shifted back to Egypt, where the Muslim Brotherhood had, as we'd assessed they would, taken control of the government through elections and appointed Mohamed Morsi as president. We were also watching Syria, where the International Committee of the Red Cross had declared that Arab Spring hostilities had devolved into a civil war. Opposition to Assad grew as he exhibited no restraint when attacking protesters, but the situation was much more complicated for U.S. intelligence and diplomacy than Libya had been under Gaddafi. Syria shared borders with Israel, a close friend, Turkey, a NATO ally, Iraq, where 47,000 U.S. troops were still fighting an insurrection, Jordan, and Lebanon. Assad was backed by Iran's government and Russia. The Russians certainly wouldn't allow the UN Security Council to pass a resolution authorizing the use of force in Syria, and, apart from the cost and risk attached to it, establishing a no-fly zone wouldn't necessarily enable the resistance to take Assad down. Because 2012 was an election year in the United States, politicians were weighing in with calls to arm the rebels in Syria, particularly Senators McCain and Graham. The Republican narrative held that President Obama simply refused to do the right thing and support the opposition to Assad. But from an intelligence standpoint, there were simply no good choices. There wasn't a united opposition force, and many of the resistance fighters were as unsavory as Assad. Some were even affiliated or allied with the Islamic State in Iraq, not exactly whom we wanted to arm. On Tuesday, September 11th, the 11th anniversary of the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon, a local militia attacked a low-security diplomatic facility in Benghazi, Libya. In the course of the next several hours, Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans lost their lives.
It took weeks to record many eyewitness accounts, which varied wildly, and acquire, analyze, and correlate video from security cameras, intercepted cell phone transmissions, and an unarmed Predator drone that arrived on scene an hour and a half after the initial attack. The Predator filmed the buildings burning and the final escape of the survivors from the diplomatic